This is Don Sullivan. I'm with Bob Grimaldi, longtime resident of Polebridge, and I would say one of the more colorful people that I've known up there. Today is July the 7th, 2015, and the first thing, I want to thank you, Bob, for conducting this interview and contributing to the history of the North Fork. It's much appreciated. Now, Bob, when did you first have an inkling that you might like to come up to Polebridge, or even were aware of Polebridge?
The first time that I was aware was I took a trip. I was stationed at Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane. And the family, we took a trip up into British Columbia over into Alberta, Banff, and over to Calgary, and we came on down through Glacier National Park. And in those days, I was an avid fisherman. I first heard about the bull trout that were in the North Fork River. So it was late in the year, so there wasn't any bull trout fishing available then. I went back to Spokane, and the next spring, late spring and early summer, I came over here and fished for the bull trout. I camped at the old, used to be a campground inside the park called Riverside Campground. You just go inside the park and you go north about, on the inside road, you go north about, I think it was about 2 miles, not very far. It was right there on the bank of the North Fork. We'd go camping there and go fishing and try to catch some bull trout. That was how I first got acquainted with the area. That was in 1968. Yeah.
Did you catch any bull trout?
Oh, yeah. I caught, when you could catch them legally, I caught a number of them, but the best one was a 12-pounder and a 9-pounder.
12-pounder and 9-pounder.
Yeah.
Well, those are bigger fish than I've caught out of the North Fork, I can tell you.
I said, someday I'll, I think I'd like to buy some property around here. Bob Olson owned the store at that time, and I remember asking him about land for sale, and he said, no, there's nothing for sale up here. It's all bought up. I said, really? And he said, yeah, between the Forest Service and the big landowners, he says, there's nobody selling property. Well, gee, I'm surprised. I didn't know any better in those days to inquire a little further, but so I assumed that was true. And, then in 1974, I was stationed at 73 or 74, I forget which. I was stationed at Fort Leonardwood, Missouri, and I used to get a copy of the Hungry Horse News all the time. I had subscriptions about every year, and I got a copy one day in the mail, and I saw an advertisement that there was some land for sale at Polebridge. So I went to my boss and I said, I need 3 or 4 days off or a week. He says, well, what do you need it off for? I said, well, I want to go to Montana and check out some land that's available. And that was in November. It was late in the year. And got to Spokane, flew into Spokane, and I was going to rent a car and drive over, but it got a lot of snow there too. So I caught the train. I got off at Whitefish, and the guy that had the land for sale met me there. And we went up to Polebridge, and it was at least 2 or 3 feet of snow all over the place. And I looked at the area and how much land he had for sale. So that's how I bought it.
And there was no house on that land, right?
No, there was nothing. It was just no trees, just a few shoots of aspen trees. And, all the trees that you see there now, I planted every one of them. Bought some, transplanted some. And I didn't start, I would, when I left the military in 1975, I had a job at Washington State over in the Seattle area. But every time I had any holiday time or whatever I could get off, I always came up the pole version. First thing I built was a fire pit. Second thing I had built was an outhouse. And we would pitch tents and camp and that type of thing.
Now you say we. I happen to know
my
that
family, yeah.
you've been married. You were married a few years.
54.
54 years, yeah, to yeah. Lovely Jean.
Five kids, yeah.
Five kids. Now, did Jean accompany you up when you looked at the land?
Most of the time. Yeah. Oh, when I went to the land?
Yeah.
No, she stayed behind in Missouri.
Yeah. And but she was your sidekick all those years up in Pole Bridge.
Yeah, she, when I retired from the civil service at Great Falls over at Alston Air Force Base, she knew what I wanted to do, but I asked her if you want to, what do you think, you know, and she said, oh, I don't know. She says, we got a nice home here, we have some roots here, Lord. We've been here for, we had lived in Great Falls for 12 years. On and off over a period of time. And, she gave it to what I wanted to do, which pleased me immensely because I liked Great Falls, but I wanted to try living in the wilds of Montana.
Right.
At that time, yeah.
When did you have the house built?
Started building it in 1980. Yeah. Started with the foundation 1 year, and then I think John O'Hara built the foundation for me in 1980 or 79, I can't remember. And then the next year we went up with the superstructure and gradually built it over the next 2 or 3 years. And of course, I've put two additions on it over that time. And Ray Brown built both additions and built the garage I have out there. No, I'm sorry, Ray did build the garage. Ed Neneman built the garage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you have what I would consider to be one of the more interesting and nicer fences around your place. Can you tell me that story?
Well, I had one fellow up there say, I probably did that out of boredom, you know. nothing could be further from the truth. I, over in just north of Fairfield, California, Fairfield, Montana, Highway 87 over there between Shoto and I think it's Fairfield. Is it Fairfield?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Yeah. The guy had some similar structures outside of his house there. And I stopped one day and I went over and looked at him, see how he had them up, when he put them together and so forth. And so I said, yeah, I'll put a couple of those up around the house. And I had a guy from, he was working for, the seventh day Adventist fellow up the road. What was his name? I'm forgetting the other thing, huh?
The school teacher.
Who?
The school teacher.
Yeah.
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 Jerry
Wernick.
Wernick.
Wernick. Yeah, he had a mason working for him up there, so I had him build me the two structures where I put the entrance way up and put that on. I said, well, let me just put a couple of these on each side. And a couple on each side, put some logs in them. She said, gee, they look pretty good. So I said, I think I'll just do the whole front up there, you know. Then after I did that, I saw it picking rocks up all over the place up there. Everywhere you could imagine, I'd put hauling rocks. I think a lot of people saw me out there with my old truck, loading rocks and hauling back. And you had to get two types. You had to get the good-looking ones. Then you had to get the scrap rocks to fill inside, you know, to hold them.
Right, right.
Put a railroad tie inside on top of a trailer pan. Then build it up and put the wire fence around it.
Yeah.
So, for a long time, I was taking rocks out of the river. And I didn't know that it was against the law. I had no idea. So, for about 2 years, I think I was taking rocks out of the river, you know. And one day, my daughter and her grandson, her son, my grandson, we were down by the river, down by Great Northern Flats, and I had a truck all full of rocks. We're just about ready to leave, and here comes a summertime ranger. He says, do you know it's illegal to take rocks out of the river? I said, no, I don't know. And he said, well, he says, it is. And he says, you have to empty them, put them back. I says, you got to be kidding me. He says, no, he says, I'll give you a citation, but you have to put the rocks back, you know. Okay. I'm going to run out of breath here.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. Tell me when you want to stop.
And so I got the citation, got a call from the guy from the Park Service. I mean, from the Forest Service. Law enforcement guy, I can't remember his name. He said, how long have you been taking rocks out of the river? I said, taking rocks out of the river for a couple of years. And, he said, well, he said, it was against the law. And he said that you got to take the rocks back, put them back where you got them. And I said, by that time I had well over half of my fencing built up there. And I said, well, that's going to be impossible. I said, I have rocks that I picked up on the road, that I picked up on Hay Creek, up on the, all the way up north and along the road. And I got rocks from everywhere up there. I don't know which ones came out of the river, you know. So he was going to come up and see me and talk to me about it. Well, he wanted me to come in. And I said, well, I don't have time to come in. And I said, you know, if you want to talk to me, you can come up here, you know. Well, he said he couldn't get up for 3 or 4 days. I said, well, I'll be here. So 3 or 4 days later, I get a guy from the Forest Service comes and calls me. His name is Fred. He said that once his name couldn't make it, I said, well, okay. He said, well, he says, you know, he says, what we're concerned about is that you were selling the rocks. And he said, the problem is that there are people that have been taking rocks out of the river and then they sell them. And I said, well, he said, I noticed that your license plate on your truck was from Cascade County, a 2 instead of a 7. He said, that's why we thought you might be buying rocks and hauling them over to Great Falls and selling them. I said, I have never sold a rock. Every rock I've used, I said, you can see what I've done out here. You know, he said, yeah. He says, well, he says, I think we're going to let it pass. He says, but, you know, he says, you really ought to put the rocks back. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I says, you tell me which rocks came out of the river and where they came from, and I'd be glad to take them back. He kind of smiled and said, well, I guess you know I can't do that. And I said, that's right, you can't. I said, so what rocks I have, I'm keeping, and but I won't go take rocks out of the river anymore. So that was the end of that story.
That's a good story, and I've heard that. I've heard other people tell that story too.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a good story. What do you remember about the North Fork back in the late 60s, early 70s that might be different than today?
Vastly different. Different world entirely. Road was narrow. Some places you'd have to pull over a little bit to let somebody by. Everybody waved. Everybody waved. On the road. Everybody you met waved. There was road was muddy up there by the in the spring, up by Tom Ladberg's place. You couldn't even get through in the spring. Well, you could just barely get through if you had four wheel drive before they paved it, and then going up. Vance Hill was a much more dangerous experience than it is now. And coming up Fool Hand Hill was an experience too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There weren't any rocks in the road, were there, in those days?
Not too many rocks, no. No, no, it was more ruddy. It was a lot of places were ruddy and muddy and... So that's what I remember most about it. There's just very few people. There wasn't that many people up there.
Didn't have many neighbors in those days either, did you?
I can't. You know, when I bought the land, there was the Uptons weren't there. John O'Hara wasn't there. Tom Reimer wasn't there. The only structure I remember seeing, it was two structures down below me, back down towards town, you know, in the meadow there. There's one that's still there. It's off to the left slightly in the woods. Then there was another one, that old structure that became the church that burned down. Those are the only two structures that were there.
So you've
been when I bought the land.
You're kind of a pioneer then.
Well, those are guys. I don't know the name. I remember the names of the people. But I've forgotten who they were now. I think that one old structure is still owned by the original owner. I don't know. I know some lady that was a. I can't remember her name. She became a school teacher. She went off to Alaska, I think. She lived in one of those cabins for two or three years. And then I think the guy that owned that church was named Chadbourne. Chadbourne?
No, no.
That's the one that character was the so-called minister.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah.
What was his name?
Bo
Tanner.
Bo Tanner, right, yeah. The Reverend Bo Tanner, who had a couple of secrets that... What were those secrets, you remember?
What was that?
What were his secrets?
Oh, everybody knows those. Yeah. He was a good character. I bought some rails. I had a buck fence built on my property. And I bought some rails from him, and I got, tons of rails, a lot of rails. For $500, I thought, what a deal. And it was. I mean, he cut up the length and delivered them to me for $500. Even back in those days, that was a deal, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I never had any problems personally with Bo Tanner, you know.
Sure.
I know the first incident I heard of is... something attacked one of John. Was it John Frederick's pigs or something? Or
John Frederick had pigs.
Well, was it a pig or a goat? I don't know. So that was the first uproar over something about Bo Tanner and John Frederick's going to appear. I don't know what it was. You know, in those days, you heard about it. I don't know the facts of the matter, but it seemed like it was something along that line.
Did you have any encounters over the years with animals?
Oh, I had a couple of beautiful encounters. I had one year, grizzly bear. I had dog food in my garage, and I had a metal door, enclosed. But, of course, the bear could smell the dog food. And the first thing he did was I had like three oval windows in my garage door. And he broke out the windows trying to get in. They were plexiglass windows, and he just broke them out, And the next day, he came back. No, he broke them out, and then you could see where his paw prints were on the door, and you could see, because it had rained and it was muddy, you could see where he tried to put his claws under the door, obviously wanting to lift it up. But he couldn't break the, had the doors locked, so he couldn't get it up.
Pretty smart bear, though.
Smart bear, yeah. Well, I got another one even smarter than that. But then two or three days later, I moved my dog food. I called the bear guy, Tim Manley. And he said, well, you got to move that dog food out of there. And I said, okay, well, I got a couple of sheds. I'll put it back there. So I put it in one of my sheds with a 3/4-inch plywood door, pretty well framed, had it locked, put the dog food out there. Well, two or three days later, the bear was back. That bear got his claws under that door. He ripped 3/4-inch plywood out about 2 or 3 feet up. He ripped the whole thing out the door. But for some reason, he didn't go in there. I don't know why or what happened. And then the next, so Tim Manley brought me a critter getter,
mm-hmm.
a little thing that if anything moves out there, beep, 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 scare the critters away. So I put a critter getter out there, and I had Mike Eddie put in some floodlights out there for me. So, the bear came back a few weeks later, and I heard the critter go off about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I got up and clicked the lights on, and here was she was a good-sized bear, and she had a cub with her, and the lights, she looked, and she left. Then the other one, the other two, is two more if you want to hear them.
Yeah, I want to hear them.
When I would come in from Great Falls, I would always bring some food. And, of course, I always had red boxes, and I'd bring the food in the house and put the boxes out on the porch to burn the next day and do whatever, but I put some out there one night, and it was around 11 o'clock at night, and we were still up and everything. I heard a noise out on the porch, and I had a kindling pile out there, a little wood pile of kindling, so I could just go on the porch, take it to the house. We had a curtain that covered the whole front of the house that was all glass in those days, or glass doors. I didn't have any framed in a door like I have now. I had all sliding glass doors, two of them. So I opened up the drapes, dark out, it was a dark night, there was no moon, I couldn't see anything, so I had my flashlight, a big flashlight, and I put it out there, and right in my, right in the door was, a massive head. I don't know how big that guy was, but he was pretty big. Massive head looking right back at me, eyes shining. And I said, holy, I told my wife, get upstairs. He was big enough to, if he had wanted to, he could have forced those glass doors open, you know, right. If he wanted to. I'm sure of it. Of course, you always think things are bigger than they were when you see them that close, but still, I think he could have. So my wife went upstairs, and I shut the drapes and went up there myself for a while, and he apparently took off, but that was an interesting experience.
Then you had a little car trouble too, I hear.
A what?
You had a little car trouble.
Right, yeah, that was a... I'd been down to Polson looking at a dog down there. And the lady gave me some carrots and a bunch of root vegetables that she had there. She said, would you like some of those vegetables? I said, sure. So I filled up a box, of the vegetables. And I stopped at the theater in Kalispell to see that movie Secretariat about the horse race. It was a Saturday night. And by the time I got back to Pullbridge, it was late at night anyway, 11 maybe, 12, I don't know, late at night. So I knew I should have taken those vegetables out of the car, but it was late, I was tired. I said, I'll get up in the morning, I didn't think a bear was going to bother vegetables, but I thought he might go for me, you just don't make a good decision. So I go in the house, go to bed. This was after my wife had died, and I got up the next morning about, as I usually did, about 7, made some coffee and opened up the blinds and sat there and had coffee and some breakfast. Go out on the porch and I see a black object laying on the ground by my car. Look at it. What the heck is that? So I go down, pick it up. I look at my car. It's a door handle off the passenger side. I said, what the heck? I start looking. The rear door handle is off on the ground. So you gotta be kidding me. I go around to the other side. Both door handles are ripped off on the other side. The rear door was a Ford Explorer. Had been molested, the door opening thing, but it, you know how it, you have to click it up, and somehow the bear couldn't get that up. He went to the other two and broke those open. And that cost me $450 to get the door handles replaced, all for a few vegetables that I was stupid and didn't bother to take them out the night before, That's about my major experiences. The other one that was fishing up on Hay Creek, way up, all the way up to where it flattens out. You know where that is, don't
mm-hmm,
you?
I do, yeah.
They had some nice, maybe you'd hook a lot of 6-7 inches, but every once in a while you get an 8, maybe 9 inch or something. Not too much, but boy, they were wild. And I had a little fishing rod, a small fiberglass rod, a little reel, light line, 2-pound, 4-pound test, and they were fun to catch. And they were good to eat too, But I was down in there fishing. It's tough getting in there too. The bank is close, not too many places where you had much room to throw back. You just throw a little MEP spinner in there, a little silver MEP spinner, and zap, But I was working up the stream, and I came around a corner, and there was a lot of debris in the stream and so forth, and it was a hot day, and the water was pretty good, flowing down. And on the other side of the bank, maybe 25 yards upstream, was a grizzly. He was facing away from me. He wasn't looking towards me. He was looking upstream. And I think what probably saved me was there was a the breeze was coming downstream with the cold water. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he could smell me because mm-hmm. he wasn't facing, you know, the wind wasn't coming into him. I'll tell you what, I packed out of there as fast as I could, scratched, beat up. All I cared is I got to get out of here. It was about a good quarter of a mile down in there, you know, yeah. from up at the road.
Yeah.
And one more bad story, and it amazed me. Going up Hay Creek where you have all that scree mm-hmm. running up the hillside. Again, I come around the corner, and I had my son and a friend of his was sitting on the back, riding on the back of the truck, and my wife was with me. And come around the corner and around a little curve there, right in the middle of the road, there's a beautiful bear, just beautiful. He was probably about, again, maybe 20 yards away at the most. And my wife sees the bear, she starts screaming. We got the window open to the back of the truck, and she's screaming at the kids to get in the truck, you know, she's carrying on. And the bear turned and looked at the truck. I'm watching the bear, and what I think happened between my wife screaming and the bear turning around and looking at the truck, what he did next was, you know, in the old cartoons, you always saw a bear running or something, and you would see them take their hind feet and put them almost behind their heads. You ever see pictures like that?
Yep.
That's what this bear did.
Really?
He put his legs, and he hit that road, and he was gone up that screen. I'll tell you what, he was out of sight within moments. He was gone out of sight. I think what he may have done is that he was surprised by the truck, and he turned and saw the truck with the big headlights and, you know, and my wife screaming. In his mind, he may have, I don't know how bears think, but he may have said, I've never seen anything like this. I haven't heard anything like this.
They can really go, can't they?
Oh, I was stunned. Yeah. Stunned by the speed of that yeah. bear. Uphill.
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 Yeah. Yep.
Over those rocks and everything.
Yep, I've seen it myself. So, yep, yep.
That's my bear experiences, other than seeing them, you know, here and now on the road.
Yeah, you probably saw some elk down there in the Gold Ridge.
Yeah, Lee Downs took me one year. He was, you know, he took care of Tom's place after Tom died. And in the winter, he would feed the elk. And one day he came up and says, you want to go down and see the elk? You know, he said he would take me out when he was going to take some hay out to feed him. So riding on the tractor, surrounded by elk, kind of smelly, but it was fun to do, you know.
Oh, yeah, what an experience. You can't have experiences anywhere else like we have them up the North Fork, right?
Those were something. A couple other good wildlife experiences. In November, it was like just before Thanksgiving, we were headed back to Great Falls. This is when we weren't living there full time. We come in through the park. The road was still open. And maybe about 2 miles inside the park, I see on my left what looked like a dog standing on the side of the road. And I start slowing down. It's a wolf standing on my left of my road. That was the first one I'd ever seen. This was probably it was the Camas Pack. That's when the Camas mm-hmm. Pack developed, mm-hmm. and it was on the left-hand side of the road, and it was probably, early 90s, maybe?
Yeah.
91, 92?
I think they came down in, like, 88 or 89.
So he's on the side of the road, and I see the wolf, and I'm just going, I was just wild with the excitement and joy at seeing that wolf. So I slowed down completely, and then I stopped. And here's the thing that happened that to this day, you tell people, you just think they probably think that you're stretching the story, but that wolf crossed the road, and Matthew, he or she crossed the road, here came five or six more wolves. There was about seven wolves in a troop, and they went into the woods on my right, and I'm going nuts, you know. And so I start creeping along a little bit more, you know. I'll be darned if the wolf that had just crossed the road came back on the right-hand side of the road, one wolf, the same wolf, looked around, went across the road, they came the other way. So I saw them going across, and 2 or 3 minutes later, here they come across the road again.
Wow, what an experience.
And I was just, I mean, I just went wild. And then one time, we were leaving Paul Bridge, and it was in November, it was a little later, and it was dark. And I'm between where you turn off to go out the West Glacier exit after you make your turn, about a half a mile down the road, my headlights pick up 2 or 3 elk going across the road. So I slow down, 3 or 4 more, 2, 3, 4, 5, I don't know. I, to this day, I think was at least 50 elk across the road right in front of me, you know. And just my headlights is all I could see of all, but that was exciting to see that.
Isn't that something?
And I saw a lynx once, just for seconds, but I've never seen a mountain lion in the North Fork. The only one I have seen is one that Billy Dow, the Blue Moon guy, mm-hmm. His son shot a beautiful mountain lion, and I saw him about a half hour after he'd shot him, and he was still warm and soft, and that's the only one I've ever seen in the North Fork. I've never seen a mountain lion. All the years I lived up there to travel, but I did see the lynx.
Well, they're elusive, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
They are elusive. Yeah, they're there, you just don't see
them. One time, I think I saw half a wolverine. I don't know what else it could have been, but I only saw half of it up on Red Meadow Road.
Which half?
The rear half. Yeah. He was going into the woods, and I looked. I know he wasn't a pine marten, and he was too big in the rear end to be anything other than a wolverine, as far as I could tell. A beaver would be up that far from water, and it looked like, and he was black, it looked like a high den of what I would say a wolverine, but I didn't see the front half.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know.
Well, what else would you like to say about the North Fork, your experience on the North Fork, or you know, anything at all?
Well, by and large, all of my experiences in the North Fork were wonderful. It was a wonderful place to play and live and visit, and I always wanted to do a lot of more things than I did do, but you know, can't do it all. I retired, I was 62, and I had not done a lot of hiking because I never really had the time, or you know, I always was interested in doing a lot more than I did, but by and large, most of the people up there have been very friendly and helpful. And another thing, I have that open bay, 3 open bays attached to my garage and the building, the main building, and 2 sheds. And I have never had a single item stolen from me that I know of, not a single item. One time I had a tent pitch with a lantern in it, you know, and I collapsed the tent and rolled it up, took it home, and came back the next year to, I said, where's my lantern? I know I had left the lantern up here, I couldn't find the lantern. I'm grumbling to myself, somebody stole my lantern. And I had rolled it up and taken it home. But now I have nothing but fond memories. I, of course, as you all know, I felt strongly that at least the road between Columbia Falls, between Canyon and Camas Creek should be paved. And I still believe that when it was defeated, I finally gave up the ghost. I said, well, I still have no understanding, no comprehension of why people would object to that part of the road being paved. But I do feel I was instrumental in getting the road improved. I didn't get it paved, but I got it improved, and I've been happy with the improvement. So for my detractors and those who've maligned me, I at least had that satisfaction of seeing that done.
Well, you were the founder, if not the founder, one of the founders of the North Fork Road Coalition, right?
Yeah, myself, Ray Brown, and Joe Franchitti, and they elected me chairman.
Yep.
And they didn't want to do the work, I guess. I don't know.
Well,
I did what I could. I would probably alienate a lot of people because I have a strong personality. I'm not the easiest guy to reach a consensus with. As I'm older now, it's much easier. But when I was younger, I sort of had a little bit of the highway was my way, you know, and that's from being in the military as a war officer for a few years.
Hey, tell me a little bit about that, would you? Your military experience?
Well, I retired as a war officer in 1975. I spent 60 years in the Air Force and five in the Army. So they gave me a lot of travel, spent a lot of time in Europe, almost 12 years, well, 9 years in the military, 3 years as a civilian. So lived stationed in Germany, Vietnam, Italy. So I had a good career.
Now, I happen to know that you are maybe the biggest Red Sox fan in the country, and if not in the country, certainly in Montana.
Oh, I don't know.
How did that come to be?
What, the Red Sox fan?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, when I was a kid, I had an aunt that lived in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is just south of Boston. You could take a bus, and you went to subway station at Fields Corner, which is about 3 miles away, and then you got on the subway and you rode into Kenmore Square in Boston, and you get out and you walk to Fenway Park. Well, I spent 2 summers there, summer of 51 and 52. Maybe it was 50, 51 and part of 52, three summers. And of course, tickets back in those days were not very expensive, so I spent a lot of time at Fenway Park when I was, I was 13, 14, 15 years old. And one summer I got to meet my hero, got to shake his hand, Ted Williams.
Ted Williams,
Got to shake his hand. I was, awed by his presence, like young people are when they have sports figure heroes, wasn't any bigger than him in those days.
Absolutely.
But just only the hated Yankee, Joe DiMaggio, used to get in fist fights when I was a kid with who was better, Ted Williams or Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, right. So did you grow up in Boston then?
No, I grew up in Maine.
In Maine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I had an aunt, I had two aunts who lived there in Boston, Boston area. So in the summer I'd go down there and spend some time with them. But no, I don't know if I'm the biggest, but I win, lose, or draw. I always I root for them.
For the Red Sox.
All the time. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Bob, I want to thank you for your time and for the recollections that are so important to the history of the North Fork. And, I just want to say that, I've known you for a good 30 years or maybe a little bit more, and have always respected you as one of the leading people of the community, always concerned about the community. I certainly agree with you that you made a huge impact in improving the road, and I think everyone who drives the road would thank you for that. And thank you for all the friendship that you have given to so many people over the years.
Can I talk about our first?
Oh, absolutely.
I have to tell you this one. I don't think you remember it, but up at the community center one time, Oh, this goes way back, but you came up to me, I think, and you introduced yourself, and we started chatting, and I asked you where your place was, and you told me. I said, oh, I said, I got to get up there someday and see it. And you said, yes, for sure, you're welcome anytime. You know, come on up and be glad to show you around. Somehow we got on the topic of the road at that point. And you, of course, were not a road supporter. I didn't know whether you were or you weren't, but I got on the subject of the road. And our argument got a little heated, not anything, you know, where we were going to come to fisticuffs or anything, but it got a little tense and stressful. And I remember you saying, well, maybe it's better you don't come up to see me. I got to tell that story. That happened. You can deny it, but I know it happened because I said, and for years after that, I thought, didn't think too highly of you. I didn't know you at all other than that first instance. And like we all have, we have detractors, and you had a couple. And when I told them that story, they said, they had things to say. So I didn't hold you in very high regard for quite a few years, but I don't know when it happened, but I finally, all I know, when you did your work as a clergyman, or what do you call that?
Lay pastor.
Lay pastor. Yep. I thought that was an excellent service. I remember the battle that you had to get the use of the hall, and I voted for you at that time to be allowed to use it for nothing, and I was quite upset when people voted that you had to pay. I said, this is outrageous. The man wants to give the community a connection to the Lord and faith and so forth. And, I have to say, too, that I, when the North Fork Improvement Association changed its name to the North Fork Landowners Association, I was really, really happy because the North Fork Improvement Association never improved anything. this is going down for the record, but as far as I could tell, they were clannish. They didn't seem to care for newcomers too much. I remember that back in those days. And you didn't feel welcome. I never felt welcome. Towards the end of the years, it changed, when more people started coming in. But back in the beginning, it was, I always used to say, can somebody show me what they've improved? So with that, but I still, most of the people were nothing but super first class people. A few exceptions, but we'll leave them unnamed.
Well, I totally agree with you, Bob. We had a few headbutts when we first met, but over the years, I have learned to appreciate you and your intellect and your concern and your dedication to the North Fork. And I think I can say that we have become fast friends.
Yes.
And I have enjoyed your company immensely.
I appreciate that. And yours, too.
All right, that
and you too, Sue.
Yeah, Sue
yes,
Sullivan as well. That wraps it up. And once again, I want to thank you, Bob, for taking this time and sharing these memories. They are priceless.
Good.